supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Construction along Sunoco's Mariner East 2 pipeline may have spread underground pollution in Lebanon County's West Cornwall Township. This is not the first time construction on the line has been associated with contamination. Joining me with details is State Impact Pennsylvania's John Hurdle. And John, what came of the township's press conference on this incident last week?
Well, the first thing we learned, Dave, was that there was an explosion during rock blasting, and that occurred on September 11th. One result of that was that a nearby house and a swimming pool was showered with debris. They also discovered the appearance of an unidentified sheen on the surface of the water at the blasting site. That led to an order by the Department of Environmental Protection to remove 8,000 gallons of liquid that was being treated as hazardous material. The township now says that Sunoco, which is building the pipeline, will remove contaminated soil to a depth of 10 feet at the site. The township released a statement on September 25th, but called a press conference last week because it wanted to correct what it said were inaccurate rumors flying around the community.
What more is known about the material in the water and soil being removed from the site?
As of last week, a township official said he hadn't confirmed the nature of the material, but it appeared that it came from an underground plume of MTBE, an additive for gasoline that was stored at a nearby Sunoco depot that closed in 1993. Officials have known about the plume for years, but say that it has migrated to the area where the pipeline's being built and was brought to the surface by the blasting. The water was tested by an analytical company hired by Sunoco to deal with so-called legacy contamination. The water well belonging to the house that was hit by the debris was found to contain numerous contaminants, including benzene, a known carcinogen. The owner was immediately provided with bottled water, and carbon filters were fitted to the house.
What's the purpose of the use of explosives?
Because there are some parts of the pipeline route where there is too much rock to be efficiently removed by using heavy equipment, and that's according to Sunoco spokesman Jeff Shields. Shields says that blasting is a permitted activity that's strictly controlled.
So then is there some question whether those controls were followed in this case?
Well, it certainly does raise those questions. The township says the blast went wrong because the explosive was too tightly packed into holes in the rock, causing it to detonate out of sequence and leading to the debris, which Sunoco says was mud, being sprayed on the house. Shields says the house has been cleaned up to the owner's satisfaction and that the responsible contractor has been removed from the job.
So far, we're discussing the township and Sunoco. What role does the Department of Environmental Protection play in all this?
The DEP says that they're investigating. They're familiar with the facts of the case, but they haven't provided any details yet on what they've found or whether they will impose any penalties on Sunoco.
Now, is this the first matter Sunoco has had with explosives during construction?
To my knowledge, it is, but the 350-mile natural gas liquids pipeline has had numerous other issues in other locations since it started construction in February. The incidents include some residents getting cloudy water in their wells because pipeline drilling punctured aquifers, and there have been dozens of spills of drilling fluid leading a state court to temporarily halt drilling until tighter controls can be put in place. And those spills include three in West Cornwall Township in September, and at least one of those is still shut down.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome, Dave.
State Impact Pennsylvania's John Hurdle on NewsWorks Tonight. For 3 years, police in Newcastle County, Delaware, have been working to crack cold cases using new scientific methods, even social media. WHYY's Mark Eichmann has more on the Cold Case Squad.
In 1985, 54-year-old Wilmington piano teacher Joseph Braun was severely beaten to death inside his home. His car was later found in Philadelphia, and while Newcastle County Police had a suspect in mind, no one was charged. A tip police received in 2001 led detectives to search for a woman named Sandra Hartzag, but detectives were unable to find her. That is, until 2015. The newly formed Cold Case Squad found her thanks to Facebook. Hartzog checked in on the social media site in Dalton, Georgia, where she had been living. 30 years after Braun was killed, Hartzog was charged with his death in the first case solved by the squad now made up of the team of Glenn Davis and Detective Brian Shahan.
When we take over a case, it takes 3 to 4 weeks at least just to dive in.
Detective Shahan is a 20-year veteran of the Newcastle County Police.
We're looking at finding the evidence, looking at all the reports and digging into it and just going back instead of trying to pick up where everything left off, you go back and you do the initial crime report.
Glenn Davis retired from the department in 1995 and now works on the cold case squad as a civilian. The science of detective work has seen big advances since his early days when he relied on fingerprints and other basic evidence collected on scene.
It's a whole new era of criminal investigation. It also, the DNA technology, when I retired, it was very much in its infancy stage. Today, it is probably one of the most investigative tools that come across the criminal investigator's mind when they're doing a criminal investigation, and is very successful. And that technology continues to grow. That was my biggest curve when I returned.
But Shahan has helped his partner get up to speed. Since its inception in 2014, the cold case unit has made several arrests, some cases dated back to the 1980s, like the one of the murdered piano teacher. Shahan credits old-school patience, new technology, and critical thinking.
We slow down and we dig into, from the bottom all the way to the top. And it does make a difference because we have time to look into it. And then we also have time to approach it in different angles and different ways.
Davis says it also helps that he and Shahan can depend on each other.
My partner is, he has his 20 years in, and him and I have developed quite a friendship and a working relationship, and we trust each other.
Shahan also credits their ability not to take themselves too seriously, something that started with their first meeting.
At the time, I think I was 42, and so he said, partner, I'm 60-something years old, I work out 6 days a week, and I eat healthy. And I said, all right, well, I'm 42 years old. I stopped working out, and I eat like crap. Excuse my language. So right then and there, we just kind of chuckled, and we just started feeding off each other.
In addition to searching for suspects who check in to social media, the unit is also using social media to develop leads and get tips from the public. They say some people are more willing to provide information online rather than dealing directly with investigators. So far, the unit has solved 3 cases. Sandra Hartzog pleaded guilty earlier this year for her role in the death of Joseph Braun. Shahan and Davis say they expect there's more to come. From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
In Saudi Arabia, a royal decree recently lifted a long-time ban on women drivers, so starting in June, 43 million women in the kingdom will be allowed to get behind the wheel. WHYY's Annette John Hall spoke to 3 Saudi women living in Philadelphia about their response to this newfound right.
Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world where women aren't allowed to drive. So you can imagine how Elanud Ahinde felt when she heard the news that her native country had lifted the ban.
I was so happy.
Alhinde is a grad student at St. Joseph's University. She's licensed to drive her Kia here, but she says driving is an act of independence most women in Saudi Arabia never get to experience.
It's a great feeling that when you want to get something, you just go and get it. You don't have to wait for someone. You don't have to call the driver, can you please drive me there? You don't have to deal with his moods and his, driving is going to be life-changing for us in Saudi.
Alhinde and her classmates Heba Alawami and Roa Alshire recently celebrated Saudi National Day at St. Joe's. Alhinde wears a traditional Saudi garment embroidered with sequins. Her friends wear stylish dusters over T-shirts and jeans. All of them are wearing headscarves. 2 of the 3 of them are licensed to drive in the United States. But back in Saudi Arabia, 1 family vehicle is typically driven by a man, and the second is used for a driver to transport the wife and children, Alawami says.
I have sister who work, and my mom need to do some grocery and stuff, and she need to take the driver. And it's so difficult for us back there to not drive.
The new policy is a win-win for Saudi Arabia, says Leslie Schumacher, who teaches history at St. Joe's. But he says the Saudi government's action was fueled more by its own agenda than women's rights.
The government has certain economic goals that they would like to achieve, and if the liberation of women fits those goals, they're going to undertake them. That doesn't mean that for the average woman in Saudi Arabia that she woke up and was in a very different world, in a much more free world than she had gone to bed in the night before.
The male-dominated regime still restricts Saudi women from going about their everyday lives. For instance, women must ask a male guardian for permission to travel. But Al-Shire says it's not as bad as it sounds.
Me, personally, I'm not affected by it at all. Like, my father, when he, like, gets our passports, he gives us that allowance, so I don't think about it at all, like it's not in my head, but I know that some women are affected by these rules.
She points out Saudi women got the right to vote in 2011, so she thinks the country is moving in the right direction. And in at least one way, it's further ahead than the United States.
I saw this record. I was surprised by it. 20% of the representative in the council assembly are women, as opposed to in the U.S., they're only 19%. I was surprised by that. Yay, Saudi. Go Saudi Arabia, I guess.
And Al-Hinde says she'll be forever grateful to her country for paying for her education.
Who else gets a full scholarship from their country? We thank Saudi Arabia and we love them, but we love Saudi Arabia more because of the new law. We love it more.
Annette John Hall, WHYY News.
Today is Columbus Day, a federal holiday some prefer to call Indigenous Peoples Day in deference to Native Americans. To help mark the occasion, members of the Iroquois Nation performed traditional dances at the Museum of the American Revolution. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the museum also screened a new film about the Native American involvement in the Revolutionary War.
At the Museum of the American Revolution, members of the Mohawk tribe from upstate New York performed a variety of traditional dances, including this one, a fish dance, celebrating a staple part of their diet. Upstairs in the permanent exhibition, the museum devotes an entire room to the Oneida tribe, which sided with the rebel colonists during the Revolutionary War. But most of the Iroquois nations, including the Mohawk Nation, sided with the British. Jordan Smith, a Mohawk performer, says the American Revolution caused a violent rift in a centuries-old confederacy of Native nations.
It was almost like a civil war between our own people. And in the long run, we all kind of got the short end of the stick, no matter what side you fought on.
The museum is using Indigenous Peoples Day to premiere its new documentary film by Rick Burns, the younger brother of Ken Burns, called The People of the Standing Stone, about the breakup of the Federation of Six Nations.
And here the whole tradition for centuries has been, above all else, to stand together. We must not kill one another. And they start killing one another. It's a total bloodbath.
Vice President of Collections, Scott Stevenson, says the film is part of the museum's effort to tell the story of the revolution from many perspectives.
I think it makes a more approachable history. It's one that we can relate to as people, that things aren't necessarily just demigods and villains, but people who were caught in those difficult situations, who had difficult choices to make.
The 25-minute film, screening exclusively in the museum, was commissioned by the Oneida Nation. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
A group of Philadelphia artists is mobilizing to get relief to Puerto Rico after the worst hurricane in 80 years devastated the island last month. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo reports.
It's been more than 2 weeks since Hurricane Maria demolished Puerto Rico, but Raquel Salas Rivera can't shake the horror of it all.
I can't even begin to describe what it's like to see a world collapse. I've been like crying for weeks, like not sleeping. You know, this is me and a lot of other Boricuas in the diaspora. Like, it's just devastating to watch. Puerto Rico's not going to be the same ever.
Salas Rivera felt driven to do something to speed up the island's recovery, so the South Philadelphia poet is joining other local artists to raise money for relief efforts. Salas Rivera is focused on evacuating LGBT citizens from Puerto Rico to Philadelphia, where the Mazzoni Center will provide free medical care. Artist Grimaldi Baez is raising money to buy solar lights and water filters. He hopes the generosity that helped him raise more than $10,000 in a week will evolve into political activism.
Hurricane Maria, we say, was a slap in the face, but it was a slap in the face from Mother Nature to wake us up from the people that were burning the house down. This is our new reality, these devastating catastrophic storms due to global warming, and we need to create a political response, a posture of engagement, and to deal with these things and not expect NGOs and nonprofits and governments to do the work for us.
Art can empower a community, Baez says, and in Puerto Rico, he hopes artists will be powerful enough to counter a hurricane. Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
For listeners increasingly fatigued of the weighty world news coming our way, hitch your wagon to Elon Musk. Joining me in conversation is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, it's a simple answer. Leave the planet.
Maybe that could be the answer we're looking for. If you can't beat him, just leave him. In this case, Elon Musk, as we have heard in the past, has some pretty interesting ideas for how to make us a multi-planet species. Not to avoid the problems here, but simply because he believes that as a multi-planet species, it opens the door for us for a greater understanding of so many different things, and also helps to ensure, in the words of Stephen Hawking, the continued existence of humans because we've been able to get off the planet and get out into deeper space.
He sure got the attention he wanted when he said it can be done in the next decade.
He certainly has. So what his plan now is in favor of is building one rocket system rather than having a series of different sized rockets. Simply use one rocket system to do everything we need to do. Probably the most innovative side of this, though, is that he can also see using this same structure for supersonic transport across the planet here itself. The major challenge for national agencies and commercial operations seeking to establish a foothold in near-Earth space exploration has been the cost of how to do this. They can now really see a way to make near-Earth space exploration affordable, and that's the major key word, affordable. As a friend of mine used to say a number of years ago, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. So he certainly envisions that within the next 10 years, not only can he see this new rocketry infrastructure in place, but he can also see having people on Mars in 10 years.
Let's afford him a little margin for error as far as that launch date, and we need look no further than the James Webb Space Telescope. It was originally supposed to launch, I believe, 6 years ago, and then this coming year, it's being pushed back again. What's the deal?
The problems that they've run into really point to the sort of uniqueness of this particular mission. James Webb Space Telescope is going to be, in a sense, a replacement for Hubble Space Telescope. It's actually an additional tool to be used for the exploration of the deepest parts of the universe using an infrared telescope, one that detects heat signatures of objects and environments in the universe at extraordinary distances, mostly to be used for helping to understand how the universe formed and came into existence and evolved, and also to look for details around extrasolar planets, planets orbiting other stars. But James Webb is a unique instrument because, unlike Hubble Space Telescope, James Webb Space Telescope will not be serviceable. Hubble Space Telescope had 5 servicing missions. It was only 400 miles up above the Earth's surface. James Webb is going to be 930,000 miles away, so the spacecraft has to be in absolute perfect condition when it's launched. Otherwise, it could be a complete failure at nearly 1 million miles away from Earth. So the problems that have come up are actually systems integration into the spacecraft, and that means putting together all the components into the launch vehicle in just the right way so that everything deploys properly once it gets on location.
We have a moment left. What's available to be seen in the night sky this week?
I'm really encouraging folks to find a way to get out to see a dark evening sky, especially looking for the Milky Way, the arms of our galaxy as we see them from right here on Earth. We're viewing our galaxy now almost edge-on in the sense that we can see the Milky Way as it stretches up from the south horizon up overhead and then trails off into the north-northeastern portion of the sky.
If you envision the Milky Way as a disk with arms, what arm or part of the disk do we occupy?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are out in the outskirts of our galaxy. Our galaxy is about 100,000 light years in diameter. We're about two-thirds of the way out from the center in what I think of as the celestial boonies, along what's called the Sagittarius Arm. It's a spur that actually is between the Orion Arm, that's out a little bit further than we are, and the Sagittarius Arm that's just in slightly closer toward the center of the galaxy.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.